The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Weekly, I'm Tom Clark.
Make no mistake, if we cut ourselves off from Europe, from the countries that we trade with more than anyone else, then our hard-won economic recovery will simply be thrown away.
The debate here today is between a tired status quo, defending a crumbling European Union that frankly isn't working anymore, and a fresh approach which says, let's be friendly with Europe, let's trade with Europe, but not be governed by their institutions.
In the first televised leaders' debate, the polls show a clear win for Farage against Clegg, while Cameron and Miliband stay away. Also this week, don't play it safe, Ed. Left-of-centre think tanks tell Labour to be bold with its manifesto as the party loses ground in the polls. And as Tony Benn is laid to rest, we look at the impact that he made on British politics. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's leader writer Anne Perkins, our political diarist Hugh Muir, and our sage and guide Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, it's still 8 weeks until Britain votes in the European parliamentary elections, but this week's televised debate on membership of the EU between Nick Clegg and Nigel Farage set the tone for what's likely to be a campaign beset with contentious facts and emotional appeals. Farage claimed that Britain spends £55 million each and every day on the EU, while Clegg claimed that 3 million people would be out on the dole straight away if we pulled out. Both claims are dubious in the extreme. So, Michael White, it was billed as a debate, but wasn't it more of a mudslinging argument?
Well, a bit of mudslinging would be very dull if it was all high-minded. Not much chance of high-mindedness while a Lib Dem and a UKIPper are in the frame. But people very much run on emotion here. It's a tribal thing. Nigel Farage was first time up on a big sort of occasion like this in many ways. The BBC ignored him for years, so did The Guardian, and now they're all over him like a rash. And, you know, he did quite well, and he didn't fall over. He looked a bit uncomfortable. Well, he might. Went to the pub before the event, so he boasted. They're always boasting about getting plastered at UKIP conferences. I've been to many. And, of course, he comes up with simple, reassuring, nostalgic platitudes about foreigners. If only we could get rid of them all. Well, not the ones we want, obviously, he always adds quickly, because he's not daft. And, people respond to that at an emotional level, and it's no use saying, well, he wasn't, rational and articulate and feet on the ground like Clegg. A lot of people out there dislike the political elite and their answers, and Nick Clegg, Mr. Smoothie, embodies much of that dislike. So, really, what we expected was what we got.
Hugh, the recent polling on in-out on the referendum sort of shows almost exactly 50-50, depending on which poll you look at. The last couple I've seen have shown the ins just ahead or the outs just ahead. So it might be split down the middle, but it's two tribes now, isn't it?
It's about the tone, and I think that was exemplified by the debate, because on the one hand, as you say, the polls says that it's 50-50, but the tone of the UKIP side of the argument, the tone of those people who don't like the EU, is much more brash and much more populist than the other side. And so to that extent, Nigel Farage had quite an easy job to do. I think one of the sketch writers this morning was saying that really he won just by turning up, because he's pretty much got the wind at his back, and that's something the political class have to think about as to why his argument, that kind of populist easy argument, is so easy to make, whereas Nick Clegg had a very difficult job to do. And to some extent he won as well, because it's raised his profile in a way that doesn't associate him with the coalition government, which is something that he's seeking to do. But it's very easy to make we need to get out, the EU is terrible, in a kind of very sexy populist sun tabloidish kind of way. It's much harder to make the other argument in that way.
So it might not be perfect, but
yeah. So it was a kind of bit of a mismatch, really.
Now, Anne, what do you think? I mean, there was no knockout blow, was there? No one's saying there was?
There really wasn't a knockout blow. And I came away thinking, that was a kind of sort of quite a big points victory for Farage. And then I kind of thought about it a bit more and looked at the tracker worm, the great tracker worm, and which is where viewers register their opinion on our website. And Clegg was kind of zero pretty well all through to about the last 10 minutes. And Farage was kind of, you know, quite positive until the last 10 minutes. And I felt it too, that sense that, well, you know, when he was making the easy arguments, the why don't you give us a referendum argument, you know, good populist case, and what can we do about 450 million people who all have the right to come and live here? He's got this way, Farage, hasn't he, of posing a question as if the worst is going to happen. It was enjoyable to see him caught out all over again on the 29 million Romanian and Bulgarians, slightly more Romanians and Bulgarians than there are in Romania and Bulgaria who are going to come and live here. But when it came down to that, to the more detailed argument, the more nuanced argument, which Clegg's good at, whether or not you like his style, Farage began to look hot and uncomfortable and bothered, and he started to lose people at that point. And I felt that's maybe why he came up with that bizarre and wild accusation at the end about the EU having blood on its hands over the over Ukraine because we'd upset Putin and it was all Europe's fault.
Do you think he wants to sound interesting? Is he more interested in being interesting than he is?
That was the most interesting thing which was said by either of them all night. That's a real can of worms, that is.
I agree. It was certainly interesting, yes. And on the question of whether he wants to sound interesting, I mean, he's definitely a bit of a drama queen, isn't he? I mean, he loves performing, and he loves performing in a way that Clegg doesn't. Clegg is a bit of a kind of bureaucrat, a eurocrat, very smooth, good with numbers, good with arguments, and Clegg's a bit of Farage is, you know, is as we all know, a bit of a performer, and maybe that is partly it. But I thought the pub bore, you know, who's just kind of had gone one pint beyond amusing, was kind of where he ended
but
up.
But isn't that why these debates are all good fun, but I think you mustn't attach too much importance to them in terms of actually driving forward any sort of discussion, because, as you know, in debating is a very technical thing. And so it's, you know, it's very easy for Nigel Farage to throw in this thing about Europe having blood in its hands, knowing that that is the thing that people will remember. But it won't actually have given us any idea as to what we need to talk about or where we need to go in terms of Europe. It's a debating strategy. And I think it's really dangerous if we look to general elections and we say the debate should become an important part of how people make that decision.
Because but it is an important
very specific
part.
Thing.
If you people go on emotions, they have on the look of people, how they feel about them. Some people last night will have seen Nick Clegg as a ponced up public school idiot from the south of England and looked at honest Nige, and other people who thought, people I was talking to this morning, what a slime ball that Nigel Farage, what a creep. You know, people react emotionally and viscerally to what they see as well as what they hear, and that's what made me so intrigued by the blood on Europe's hands remark, which we can't dismiss out of hand. It is blood hands or otherwise. It is a problem that the Europeans maybe have given Western Ukraine, as it were, too much encouragement and too much hope that it would all be easy, and it never was going to be. There's a real argument there,
just as there is about
Putin's case. But why did Farage make it? It's a left-wing argument, and it's a narrow nationalist argument. It's an isolationist argument. He's saying we want to be out of Europe, and we don't have anything to do with, you know, the international order, as it were. And that's getting into dangerous territory.
That, isn't it? It's just him saying, look, Europe made a mess of this. Rely on Europe.
It was more than that.
If you give Europe an air force or you know, a military wing and a foreign policy, then they'll do this sort of thing all the more often.
Absolutely.
I think that was the kind of context.
That's why there's always good mileage.
But Mike, I would take you up on this point. You know, this was the only interesting thing. The point was that when you get two people coming at such diametrically from such diametrically opposite positions, you don't get a debate. You get, you know, a fact-slinging fest. If you've got three people who all think that the mobility of labour is a good idea, but, you know, maybe it needs to be moderated in some way, or you need to think more creatively about how to police it or whatever it is, then you might have an interesting discussion, don't you think?
If Nigel Farage has many qualities, but the ability to engage in close-quarter debate on issues of substance is not one of them.
Mike, let's just talk about what it would mean if there were more than two people. It was just him against Nick Clegg, and Nick Clegg, despite his talk radio training, is, you know, still a fairly unpopular politician and an easy target. On the other hand, wouldn't it work rather well for Nigel Farage if there were a four-way leaders debate and he were able to play the insurgent against all of the rest of them at once? He wouldn't then
It might. I was thinking this morning that maybe Cameron and Miliband, who will have either watched it or got some expensive people to watch it for them and watch the replay, will have thought there are opportunities for us here. You know, Farage is easily rattled. And, you know, he's got a temper there, and his sort of facial grimacing was odd. I mean, I've seen him do it in audiences, live audiences, conferences, you know, the cheeky chappy making faces, but it wasn't quite right. A lot of people won't have minded, but they feel the same. But you just think up there with the big boys, and if they were any good, they could take him apart and, you know, make him look like a motor mouth who's had that extra pint and was talking.
If I were a Lib Demer, I'd be looking today to know a bit more about what UKIP actually do in Brussels. I'd be wanting to say a bit more about the friends they have in Brussels, some of whom are curious in the extreme, and just how they square this circle of being quite so critical of that organisation and then going there and having quite a nice time and taking the expenses and not actually doing very much constructive to critique it or to obstruct it. And I think you're able to say, but actually, you could, if you were in charge of anything, what would you actually do? Because you don't appear to be being very effective in Brussels.
I can imagine Farage coming back and pointing out to the fact that, you know, the EU accounts, the Commission accounts, haven't been accepted by the auditors for about 20 years now.
No, nor is his, I expect.
That's probably true, too.
Clegg had a good point when he said, you know, we did something useful for the British public and you didn't vote for it. And he said, I never vote against any of these vote for any of these things.
I think it was odd that Clegg didn't come up with a quick put down on the tuition fees argument. I thought he really needs to have a kind of effective form of words on that. He simply didn't answer it at all. But I would also say that he did, you know, get 30%+ of the vote, which by Lib Dem showing in the polls these days, you know, is pretty amazing.
You mean of the vote against Farage?
Yep. He reminded all sorts of sensible people, including moderate Tories, that there are more important issues than most of the rubbish we talk about most of the time. And, you know, Europe is one on which the Lib Dems have been unequivocal for a long time, although not all their voters are. Of course, that's a secret.
Now, if the Euros are likely to prove a testing ground for next year's general election, then this seemed like the right moment to strike for a clutch of left-leaning think tanks. In a letter to The Guardian, they urged Ed Miliband to be bold and to avoid the temptation of playing it safe. Britain, they said, needs transformational change. More specifically, or slightly more specifically, it needed co-production, devolution and prevention of the roots of social ills, as well as empowerment for all. Hugh Muir, do you not think that some of these buzzwords are actually quite close to the kind of things that Ed Miliband's been talking about and has not been cutting through with?
Well, absolutely. I think the buzzwords are half the problem. You know, you go back to Nigel Farage, he didn't use any buzzwords, he just kind of speaks. And I think Ed Miliband has to do a lot more of just speaking. And even if there are simpler ways of expounding some of the ideas that he has, I think he has to get those, to use those methods. But you then come to, what is the problem here? Is it because he isn't being bold enough? I suspect that he's being a bit management consulty about it, and he's got his grid and he's got his exciting things that he would like to unveil between now and the next election, and he's thinking, well, I will be exciting eventually, but not yet. Just give me a bit more time. And I suspect that people are just getting fed up with that. But then the other problem, the perennial problem, is of course him. And I think that Labour just don't really have an idea of what to do with him. What are they selling? And what is he? Are you saying this is a prime minister that you can trust and he's got gravitas? People obviously aren't buying that. Are they saying this is someone that you like and you'd like to have a beer with? People aren't buying that. I think they have a product, and they don't know what to do with it.
But hold on a second. They're not saying here's a man you'd like to have a beer with.
Well,
to be fair.
That.
But what was Edmund? They normally say here's someone who is very good at the Rubik Cube. They're going for the kind of geek chic thing. And can't you imagine if he were able to win, as with Kevin Rudd in Australia, there would be a brief period where people would say, well, maybe it's quite interesting and novel to have a geek.
I think they're going to have to almost position him as, you know, you might not quite recognise him and you might not want to have a beer with this guy, but he's brilliant and he's really clever. Because I think that trying to put him into the mould that we've become used to with leaders of being almost, you know, someone who could read the news out on telly at 6 o'clock in the evening, I don't think that's going to work with him. I think they've kind of tried that and I think that that's failed.
I think people are looking for more personality than that. And I think most people would rate Ed as a news reader. The one of these kind of touchy-feely polls that I saw this week that I would have thought was quite worrying for the Miliband camp was the one about, you know, it asked if all three leaders were clever, yes, I don't know, good party leaders, worked hard at school, yes, they were all about the same on that, were bullied. Nobody thought that Cameron was bullied. Not many people thought that Clegg was bullied, but a lot of people thought that Miliband was bullied. And I think that means people think he looks weak and vulnerable, and that's a really, really bad look for a leader.
There was the poll just this week, wasn't there, that talked about weird again. There's that word, that kind of millstone around his neck of weird, and what are they going to do about that? Because they really do have to do something about that, and they haven't got much time left.
Michael White, if the late Tony Benn were here, he'd be saying we need to turn to the issues and the...
He wouldn't mean it, of course, but for him the issue was Tony Benn. Oh, who said that?
We'll come back to Big Tony in a moment, but do you think if Ed Miliband got the script right, then we wouldn't have all these superficial remarks about personality and looking weird and not being the kind of person you want to take down to the dog and duck?
Tony Benn was wrong about that. Personality isn't superficial. In an age of managerial politics, high-tech politics, of the kind of world we live in now, which is immensely complicated and utterly brilliant in so many ways, but you don't wing it, then, you know, personality is all we've got. Do we trust this person? Do we think he's honest? Do we think he's decent? Do we think he's smart? These are pretty basic questions on character. And as the colleagues have been saying, Ed's a bit of an odd one. And, you know, I know he's a decent man. I was addressing a Conservative audience a few weeks ago and somebody said, do you think David Cameron believes in anything? And I said, well, I'd like to tell you that I think he does, but I'm not sure. Mind you, Ed Miliband, he believes in things and it's not doing him much good. And Ed Miliband does believe in things. He's an interventionist. He's a socialist, as he would say. And, you know, he tries to make a distinction between good corporations and bad corporations and good capitalism and bad capitalism. These are good distinctions. These are good ideas. But he's not necessarily the man to sell them because the personality, do I trust? As Anne said, is he bullyable? Factors come into play. Not very satisfactory. But I've, as you know, taken a dim view of his prospects from day one.
But when we look back, isn't this a bit, because there's a consensus here, it seems, around the table. I want to challenge it, though, because, you know, Margaret Thatcher was seen as not prime ministerial before she came in. I bet not very many people would have seen John Major coming before he became the compromise candidate. And I understand that going further back, even Ted Heath was not seen as someone you'd want to put in number 10. But once they stood in front of them...
But they all had a brand image. You think of each of them, they all had a brand image. And whether you bought into that image or you didn't, you knew what it was. And I think that that's the problem. I think the confusion over Ed Miliband and the brand image is what the problem is here. Because, you know, it must be terribly frustrating. You look at what's happened this week. You've got energy firms saying we're going to have a price freeze. When Ed Miliband said, let's have a price freeze, everyone laughed at it, on the right, laughed and said, this is unworkable. This is ridiculous.
For a week. And then they fell into line.
And then suddenly this is a marvellous plan and people are doing it.
And what's more, there's going to be a review of the energy market as well. I mean, I've had talk about Fox as being short. It's a bit poor on Caroline Fringe.
But you don't get credit for things that people just pinch them. And it happened to the Liberals for decades. They say, you know, that's a good idea, we'll pinch that. And the Liberals ended up with a lot of ropey old ideas, which everybody laughed at because all the others had been pinched. It's just happened to Ed Miliband.
So winning on the ideas doesn't do you any good. But can I suggest something else, Anne, that one thing that is a weakness that is always picked on by politicians these days, one thinks of Gordon Brown with the kind of half quote, half misattributed quote about the Arctic monkeys. The electorate has got a nose for someone who's a fake. And one thing about Ed Miliband is he's not a fake. He doesn't pretend that he had a string of girlfriends. He doesn't pretend that he likes drinking 13 pints. Here on Desert Island Disc, where he chose mostly dreadful music, but was completely at ease with himself, I thought, in a way that...
Were they his choices, do you think?
I think they probably were, because who would have advised him, oh, you'll get Worcester Woman on board by choosing Jerusalem and the South African National Anthem?
Yeah, who took
it sounded a bit geeky. It sounded a bit geeky to me.
Yeah, no, but the trouble is that not having negatives doesn't make you into a positive, does it? And people can survive negatives if they've got something else going for them. I thought actually there was an interesting piece. I'm not sure it was you who picked it up, Hugh, but that Sarah Vine, the Daily Mail columnist, and also Mrs. Michael Gove, was commenting on the fact that he was a really impressive guy to meet until he got onto this panel they were both on, when he turned into this kind of sort of think tank automaton. And I mean, people always used to say that John Major, you know, if he could meet every single person in the country, would win by a landslide. He somehow needs to relax and be himself, more than himself. Let us see what he believes in.
Mike, just very quickly on the think tanks, which is the thing I thought we were talking about. You know, is there an alliance here asking Ed to do something different, or are they just sort of saying they don't like him and they want him to be someone different?
They're all reading the polls, and they're worried, and they're right to be worried, and they've just noticed perhaps too soon. We were on this programme a few weeks ago reporting that all sorts of Labour people thought it was a home and dry, it was a shoo-in. It never was, and it isn't. No, I get nervous of lists like that. They're not real world words. None of them will ever cross Nigel Farage's lips, and he's right. They need a few simple policies. How about Tony Blair's famous five pledges? Everyone could understand that, and to be communicated effectively and well by somebody you might half trust. And that's the measure of the problem. They've got neither the policies nor the simple policies nor the personalities. People need tunes. Parties need tunes people can whistle. Somebody once said, it's a good way to put it.
The point about this is, if they are his constituency, if they are, not Doncaster, obviously, but if they are the wider constituency that he needs to keep on board, he probably needs to work a bit harder to keep them on board and to have them have some idea what the direction of travel is. Because I think probably what you take from that think tank letter is that they're a bit confused about where we're going next and what the plan is and the speed at which it will be rolled out.
Just to suck up to Tom for a minute and concentrate on that think tank letter. I mean, it was the most extraordinary letter. It was full of words that really didn't mean anything at all. And it was obvious that they didn't really actually have a consensual position either. I think there is a kind of broad criticism to make of Labour's position at the moment, which is that it's not... radical enough, in the sense of it's not really thinking about how you can, stop 2008 happening again. It doesn't. You don't feel they're grasping the kind of really severe problems, and that they're going to do anything to stop us drifting back into another kind of, you know, housing-led bubble that's destined to end in tears.
Now, someone who always tried to look successfully or unsuccessfully to the roots of the problem was Tony Benn, whose funeral is taking place today as we record. And Hugh Muir, a week on, like, some of the old spats came out. Curiously, there was a more negative and sceptical reaction from large parts of the Labour Party than there was from Parliament as a whole, which has laid him in state and been, by and large, treated him as the national treasure that he almost dreaded becoming. Have you got any thoughts a week or so on?
Whenever I met him, it struck me that in some ways it doesn't matter what you're saying with the public. How you say it's quite important. And I think that's why he was able to have people who just disagreed with him completely, but still quite like him. But I think that the fact that he had ideas and he was always willing to explain those ideas as a journalist, to the point where you would kind of say, OK, Tony, that's enough now. Yeah, stop now. I've really got to go off and live the rest of my life. Can you? Don't read me the rest of the diary. Thank you. But he was willing to explain his ideas. I think he explained them in really quite populist terms. I thought he was very clever in the way he was able to pitch his arguments as well. And I think that's why people took to him, even those people who didn't really think much for what he was saying.
And what do you think? I mean, because one of the questions that's really divided people is whether or not we should wish we had more politicians like that today. Some people say yes and some people say no, absolutely not.
I wonder what they mean when they say politicians like that. I think, do they mean people who are prepared to be kind of outriders? In which case, it's always good to have an outrider. It's always good to have somebody challenging, especially somebody who can do it, as Ben could do it, in a very kind of engaging way. And he was also, I can see why they've given him this sort of kind of parliamentary honour of lying overnight in the crypt at Westminster, because he was a very kind of committed and devoted parliamentarian, and he sat on those benches an awful lot of hours, and he understood how Parliament worked, and he understood how to make Parliament work for him, even though he did come to think that Parliament wasn't where politics was really done. And I mean, that's a perfectly respectable argument as well. So I think it was that he, I mean, going back to sort of personalities, he did have this extraordinary capacity to be authentic when a lot of us who were more sceptical about him didn't feel he was ever really very authentic at all.
Mike, what would you add?
Well, it's his funeral. I'm inclined to let it go for a while. I've known Tony Benn a long time. I knew him when he was a minister, every day of the Wilson and Callaghan governments from 64 to 79. In his diaries, he has dreams, which are sort of psychologists would analyse about. And he's torn, will he be sacked? Is he about to fall off a cliff? All this sort of thing. But ambition and power always prevailed over that nonconformist conscience. I don't see Tony Benn as a politician at all, in a way. I disagree with that. And I don't think he understood Parliament and politics particularly well. He was naive about the left. He was a parliamentarian who was very keen on the extra parliamentarians. The militant tendency weren't very nice, you know. But what he was a sort of preacher. His mother was an important figure, nonconformist background. And there's a whole strand of Labour politics, which is moral conscience, nonconformity, Puritanism, of course, a lifelong teetotaler, all that stuff. They all fit in together. So you see him in the line of John Wesley, as it were, preaching against sin and capitalism and the wickedness of the world, a bit naive about the working class. What would he know? He was born, 100 yards or 300 or 400 yards from where he's being buried, in Westminster on Millbank, spent most of his life in Westminster, including Westminster School and the Houses of Parliament. So he's fascinating, and I've been, I must say, shaken and impressed and forced to think about things by the sheer weight of enthusiasm for him and the reluctance of so many people to hear a word against him, perfectly sensible words, perfectly true. And you're just struck, this isn't really about practical politics. It's about feeling. It's about if only life could be like this, as Tony says it is. And a fascinating man, but a sort of campaigner, a sort of moral visionary rather than a middling cabinet minister, which he last was in 1979.
I know, Hugh, that he would want us to be talking about where he stood on the issues rather than just him as a kind of preacher. But where do you see it? I mean, obviously, that on the Labour right, the emphasis has been on controversial industrial policies in the 1970s and party reforms. And yet it is possible, isn't it, to say that there were a whole host of things, most recently you'd say the Iraq War, but before that things like Northern Ireland, and then also the basic question of party democracy, which even the, you know, very controversial at the time, the right to deselect MPs, but even the Conservative Party members who used to be the most deferential now have a right to vote on party leaders, and it's impossible to imagine that going back. So wasn't he ahead of his time?
I think
in
terms of policy, I'm not sure that there's much of a legacy in terms of parliamentary policy within Westminster, but in terms of the connection that he talked about between politics and people, I think that's probably more of a lasting legacy. He was conscientious constituency MP, and he, one of the things that he thought most strongly was that you need to have people play an important part in the political process, and we need to have channels through which they can do that, and you need to enthuse them, and, you know, all those that's what all those public meetings are about.
That's fine. That's fine, Hugh, but he was also an advocate of the politics of betrayal, just like Nigel Farage, dare I say it, that MPs and ministers had betrayed the people, and he did a lot of that, even when he was an MP and a minister himself.
But even if he was saying that, he was saying to the people, you've got to go and sort them out. You have a role here. You should get involved.
Well, that's right. Really, he's a bit like Ralph Nader on consumerism. He felt there should be an active democracy. democracy where everybody went to meetings every night. He really did think that sort of thing. Well, you know, he's a naive fella. How would he know? He went to meetings every night, but he's not typical. And perhaps people admired him for not being like themselves. If only I was more like Tony. I do agree with you that his impact was not on policy, economic policy. He didn't understand economics or policy much of this last bit. Constitutional reform, getting rid of the peerage, that was important for him. Getting referendums, he's the man who brought referendums for better or for worse back into the system. And as Hugh said, they all elect party leaders now. And that's in no small measure due to Bennett campaigning, even though even when he changed the rules to suit himself, he never got elected party leader.
And I guess that mention of the referendum brings us full circle. Whether or not we'd be having a debate about one now without Tony Benn is a live question. My thanks to Michael White, to Anne Perkins and to Hugh Muir. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.